The Farm in the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot Bioproven. Get what you paid for. The nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com. Welcome to Farming the Countryside. I'm Andrew McCray. 2019 was a tough crop year in many locations across the country, and in turn, crop insurance was also a very important part of the year, as prevent plant acres and low yields meant those policies paid claims. We'll take a look back and a look forward to prepare for the year ahead when it comes to crop insurance. And in the second half of our show, it's one of our popular guests, Ron Rabo from Wyoming, discussing how his family faced the challenging discussions of passing the farm from one generation to the next when multiple family members were already a part of the operation. It's all on this edition of Farming the Countryside. Crop insurance is an important part of many farms, and it makes sense that we take time to talk about it, especially in light of 2019, a year when many of us saw crop insurance pay off. Should we change the way we look at crop insurance because of the poor crop year in 2019? What about insurance levels and supplemental coverage? Jessica Hamill knows the topic well, and we took time to visit about the subject and the conversations she's having with farmers as we prepare to put another crop in the ground.
Jessica Hamill joins me, and Jessica works with FCS Financial, team leader for the northeast part of Missouri, but also very familiar with crop insurance. I know she's been in that realm for quite a while and is continuing to work with a lot of farmers on that topic. First of all, Jessica, thanks for taking time to join me and talk a little bit about crop insurance today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jessica, let's begin by looking back first. 2019 was a difficult year for many farmers. I just like your kind of your overall view of what that was like from the crop insurance side. I suspect that you had, would it be right, more claims than normal last year in your experience of writing crop insurance?
Oh, yes. So last year, even in just the state of Missouri, we had a 96% loss ratio. So it was a very, very large amount of losses that producers and policyholders saw. A lot of people like to compare it back to 2015 and kind of how 2015 looked. And really, it was similar, but I feel like the impact and the way that it lasted was a little bit longer. So I felt like in 2015, we had more corn prevent plant acres. We had that really up front. In 2019, it ended up actually being more soybean acres that were prevent plant.
Do you think that one of the big differences last year was prevent plant? Normally, when we have crop insurance, it seems like our crop insurance is going to pay off. It's because we have reduced yields maybe later in the season. But was this a really unusual year because of so much prevent plant?
It was unusual for the amount of prevent plant that we saw. We did turn around in the fall and see several losses, not to the extreme that people thought that we were going to see. So when I was talking to producers in the summer, they were saying, you know, I don't think my yield is going to turn out as high as I thought. When it actually came time to harvest, a lot of those yields came back better than expected.
Did you run into several farmers that were looking at that deadline to get corn or soybeans in as far as being able to have crop insurance on them, the planting deadline? Was that a big decision for a lot of farmers last year?
Yes. So whenever we go into a year that's looking like it's going to be prevent plant, a lot of our producers, they start calling early. So they're trying to figure out, you know, what they can do. They want to get in there and they want to get planted. So they're really pushing for dates. They're looking at dates. They're looking at different options that they have. You know, what happens, worst case scenario, they do have to file prevent plant. So we start talking about that really early. We started back March, April of last year, really talking about prevent plant, the impacts that it would have on producers, just what producers could do. Then as we started getting closer and closer to plant dates, then we start running numbers and we start, you know, going through the different options. If I file prevent plant on corn and then decide to go to beans, what happens? If I just go to beans, what happens? And looking at all those options. So it's just really important to have that close relationship where you pick up the phone, you call your agent, and they're walking through those different scenarios with you. But yes, we did see a lot of questions. We saw a lot of, you know, worry as people were trying to get into the field.
So if I took Prevent Plant last year, are there any special considerations I need to be thinking about this year as I head into 2020 regarding Prevent Plant?
No. So the good news is, even if you took Prevent Plant last year and you're a carryover insured, which means that you had insurance last year, you are still covered again this year. So if, you know, as we look at going, a lot of my producers, they're ready. They filed Prevent Plant last year. They don't want to let that ground set 2 years without getting planted. So they're really trying to get that. Considerations are things that you may look at adding to your policy. We see some producers that are, you know, either looking at taking a little bit higher level to get a little bit more Prevent Plant coverage. I've seen some of that. An option that we have as well is Prevent Plant Plus 5. So that allows producers to buy up 5% on their crop insurance Prevent Plant. So typically corn, you get 55% of your guarantee. Beans, you get 60% of your guarantee. If you buy that Prevent Plant Plus 5, you would get 60 for corn and 65 for beans. So we do see some people looking at that. The only issue with that Prevent Plant Plus 5 is that it is subject to the weather in your area, and it is not always approved.
Okay, good to know. Now, is there any reason, you know, we have a lot of farmers that might have bottom ground, they had levees. In some cases, those may not be repaired yet. Will that affect my ability to get crop insurance?
So breached levees, that has been a very popular topic. With the breached levees, that does not impact your ability to have crop insurance. So if you had crop insurance last year, you have a breached levee, you still have crop insurance. As of, I looked at it last night, we had a new RMA bulletin that came out. So as of the 26th, bulletin on the 26th, there were 27 Missouri counties that were still under that breached levee statement. 65 of those levees are still breached, and 6 are repaired but not to prior specifications. So that is absolutely, it's a huge deal for those customers that are sitting in those breached levees. They need to make sure that they're reaching out and they're having that conversation with their crop insurance agent. And the main reason for that is because it will significantly impact their premium if those levees are still breached whenever it comes time for planting. So the way that breached levee statement reads is, if the levee is breached after sales closing, or I mean the levee is still breached at sales closing date or earliest plant date, whichever is later, then they will be charged the highest risk rating in the county. In some instances, that's up to 300% of the premium that they paid last year. So I'm telling my producers, let's plan for worst case scenario. There's things we can do to help for a best case scenario. If the levee gets repaired after initial plant date, but before they get planted, we can file a written agreement. So there are things that your agent can do to help, but make your decisions on March 15th by worst case scenario, and then we hope that the best case scenario, those levees get repaired.
Let's say that I'm a farmer that I don't have levees, or at least that's not worrying me. So I'm just sitting down in the start of a new year here, 2020.
Yep.
Walk me through my decision-making process on what level of coverage I should choose, because certainly you hear that. It's the talk among us out here in the
yep.
in the fields of what level should I choose. So give me your perspective as you sit down. How do you help people select the right coverage level?
Perfect. I think that that's really an individual choice. So it varies really based on the farm and your entity. So for example, if we're looking at a producer that has irrigated, non-irrigated, then they may want to separate those out. They may want to do different coverage levels depending on their irrigated or non-irrigated ground. The other thing that we see is unit structures play a big role in crop insurance and how yours is insured. So we see some people on what we call an enterprise unit structure, which is all of that crop in the county is insured together. If you look at your farms and you say, whenever I look at my whole county, I just care that I have this yield out of everything, then an enterprise unit structure may be a good fit for you. Now, the only stipulation to that is you do have to meet a qualifier, which is 20 acres or 20% in two or more sections to qualify for that enterprise unit discount. if your farms are pretty similar, all close together, sometimes that's a good fit for you. If you're sitting in an area where you have a lot of hill ground and then some bottom ground as well, we see producers sometimes go towards an optional unit structure, which keeps those farms separate by section. And so that gives a little bit of diversity in, you know, if my hills don't produce as well as my bottom ground or vice versa, I have a little bit of coverage there. There's also some for if you're sitting in bottom ground that is high risk and then you have some hills, you can separate those out as well. And then another thing that we're really seeing pushed this year, I think they're reading a lot about it in magazines and hearing about it on a lot of networks, are additional revenue products or private products that would boost the revenue that they currently have. So our companies, all of them offer some sort of a revenue product. And basically what that does is it allows you to buy up as much as 95%. It has different ways that it's a good fit. It's not a good fit for every policy. So it's not something that I would say, yes, it works for every producer, but it's important to sit down and have that conversation and see if it works for you.
Where you're looking at those types of things, an added product to go up to 95%, what situations is that more reasonable to look at? Because certainly that's not a fit for everybody.
Nope. So typically what I'm looking for in producers that is a good fit for, I'm looking for producers who are already sitting at an 80 or 85% level. Sometimes the 75, it will work, but that's fewer scenarios. So like I said, if you're sitting at that 80, 85% level, you've already added on all the multi-peril options. So you already have trend adjusted and yield adjusted and yield exclusion, all these things that help boost your yield that is subsidized under the multi-peril program, then I start looking at private products and how those private products can help you. But I feel like if you're below that 75% level, a lot of times you can jump coverages for similar costs. So it's just important to evaluate it on an individual level.
And certainly every producer is different, but are there any considerations I should be thinking about my owned land versus rented ground that I might be cropping?
So whenever I talk to producers, we don't look at it as much based on the owned versus the rented ground. What I look at whenever I talk to a producer is I look at the amount that they're guaranteed on a revenue protection policy, and I ask them, will this keep you farming next year? So if that is based on your rented ground, you know, they're looking at that and considering rent into it. If it's owned ground, you know, maybe they have a land payment that they're considering into that. So that's my biggest question, and the way that I look at it is, so this is the amount that you're guaranteed. If nothing comes out of the ground, can you keep farming next year with that amount?
That leads me into then, from a lender's perspective, and certainly that's that perspective that many of us have to keep in consideration. Are you seeing lenders looking at crop insurance differently this year since we, for many people, had a more difficult year last year? Has that changed any lenders' expectations on what they're asking producers to keep for crop insurance?
I can't speak for all lenders, but the ones that I have seen, they are expecting their producers to keep crop insurance, but I don't know that that is extremely different than it has been in past years. So for a lot of them, you know, I think they kind of have that expectation that their producers have crop insurance and they're taking assignments on the crop insurance. But I don't really see a huge change or a huge shift from the last few years. I think the producers have always tried to manage that and have the best coverage year to year to year.
For just a moment, walk through my options as far as how we're going to set the price for corn and soybeans and where we're going to pay, because sometimes there's options that I might look at with my crop insurance as far as which prices we're going to go off of during which times of year.
Yep. So there are two different, if you have a revenue protection policy, there are two different time frames that we look at to set the price for your policy. So the first one, what we call your projected price, that is set in the month of February. And it's set off for corn, the December average, and for soybeans, the November average. Then we're going to look again at the fall. So we're going to look at the October average on corn. We're going to look at December corn again, November beans. So we look at the same thing twice a year, and that is to signify whenever a producer is getting ready to plant is that February timeframe we look at. And then as a producer is getting ready to harvest or when they are harvesting is that October timeframe. So everybody gets the same price across the board, and it doesn't vary based on what you actually sell yours for.
Now, some crop insurance, though, can I just choose to have one price option? I know that in years past there was some talk about, do you have both the spring and the fall price included in your policy, or has that changed?
Yep, no. So there is still that option. There's three policies that we write. So we write the revenue protection, which has the two different time frames. We write the yield protection, which only takes the price in the spring. And then we write revenue protection harvest price exclusion. Now, the struggle that we run into with harvest price exclusion is it's calculated just like revenue protection, but the difference is if the price goes up in the fall, you don't get to take advantage of that price increase, and it actually can hurt you. So harvest price exclusion is a policy that I would suggest everybody be extremely careful about if that's one that you look at, and just make sure you really know the ins and outs of that policy.
You know, I'd be interested just in your general overview, working with many farmers over the course of several years here. As you sit down with each one of us, are there some things that you would really recommend for us to think about ahead of that meeting as far as what information should I bring to the table and what things should have already kind of gone on in my head, if you will, before I make my decisions about a new year of crop insurance?
Yes. First and foremost is turning in production from last year. So in order for us to give a really good quote, we need production from previous years to be able to do that. The other thing that I encourage people bring to the table is an idea of how you want your operation to work and the break-evens that you need to keep farming in future years. So in other words, know how much your seed and fertilizer are going to cost, because we can help you get an insurance policy that's a little more tailored to you if we know those types of struggles. The other thing is just be open and honest with your crop insurance agent. If there's something in particular that you're looking for, bring that up and tell them, you know, is there any way that I can get extra coverage? Or, hey, I replant every year. Do you have any extra replant coverage? Because there's a lot of those products that we do have, and we can kind of tailor those to fit you the best way.
Talk for a moment about how important it is for me to keep getting my crop yields up every year, because certainly that's going to factor into what level I can get on insurance. You know, we like having insurance there, but the reality is I think all of us would just as soon have a big yield at a nice price.
Very much. So your insurance guarantee is based off of your 10-year average that's in your database. So the better yields that you have in your database, the more that you're insured for in bad years. So really, production has become a major topic of conversation throughout crop insurance, RMA. They are now starting to really look at not only your production, but is your production adjusted for moisture and test weight accurately based on crop insurance standards, not just your elevator standards? And then they also now want us to report, where did you get that number from? So when you're reporting production, is it because it's in the bin and you measured it? Is it because it's in the bin and an adjuster measured it? Or did you sell it and you have settlement sheets? The big thing with that is if they come in and they audit, they're going to look back at that record to see where your numbers came up with. And you're required to be within 5% of that number whenever you go through your audit or you start looking at assigned yields.
You know, before we wrap up our conversation here on insurance, I do want to just quickly mention pasture and rangeland insurance. Even though that deadline doesn't come up until the fall, you've already seen some claims this year. Is that right?
We've seen a few. So the way pasture insurance is purchased is it's purchased over a span, and then they have different intervals. So it's two-month intervals. So we have seen some that have started to process and pay through. Not huge amounts on it, but I found that kind of interesting because we have heard a lot of conversation about how it's still wet. So what that is telling me is that in some of my area, it is dry enough that it's a little bit lower than average. So I wouldn't say that it's extremely lower, and the last few rains may have taken care of that for us. But I would say that we have some areas that have been dry at some point.
Well, we'll be sure to visit more about that as we move through the season, because I know that's something that a lot of folks think of as far as livestock and pasture. Any things that I should be thinking about at this point, even though some of those deadlines are down the road, about those type of products?
So livestock you can buy any time of the year. The biggest thing with livestock is just kind of watch for those increased market days. That might be a good day to buy that livestock insurance. The other benefit to that is it is also subsidized. So you have a little bit of your premiums are sometimes a little bit more cost effective. With the pasture insurance, really, it's just kind of deciding, you know, what levels, what kind of coverage you need on that pasture insurance. And then the deadline for that is in November. So we've got a little bit of time on that one.
Jessica, I really appreciate the time. Any other things that we should be thinking about as we move into this new season?
The only other thing that I will bring up is SCO insurance. As people are going to FSA and they're updating their choices for their our county or PLC, just keep in mind that SCO is an option. It's an area-based coverage that buys you up to 86% from your multi-peril policy. But do keep in mind, if you're not enrolled in PLC, there is a significant penalty to buying SCO insurance. So if you are not on PLC and you buy SCO with your agent, make sure you have those conversations with them. The other thing that I will bring up is on the breached levees, we are updating on our website all of that information. So if people have questions, they're welcome to go there at myfcsfinancial.com, and they can find any of that information on the breached levees.
Good, good. Well, thank you very much for the information. You know, it's one of those things that all of us, I think, deal with, or most of us deal with, insurance, but it's important to remember and think about as we head into the season. And hopefully we'll have a season where we don't end up needing very much crop insurance. I hope we have some good yields this year. That would be nice.
I hope so. That's what I tell everyone. I hope I just get to talk to you for happy reasons and not because we're filing claims this year.
You'll notice Jessica and I briefly discussed pasture, rangeland, and livestock insurance. It's an important topic, and we'll try to work that into future conversations about those specific lines. I found that those types of insurance are ones with which people aren't very familiar, yet they are policies that can be of benefit to many, so we'll discuss them on a future show. We need to take a break. Farming the Countryside is sponsored by Pivot BioProven. Everyone knows that plants need nitrogen to grow, and now there's a way to make sure corn plants have the nitrogen they need every day. Synthetic nitrogen is susceptible to loss, and applying mid-season can be time-consuming and costly, if you can get in the field at all. Pivot BioProven's nitrogen-producing microbes bond tightly to corn roots, transferring ammonia to the corn plant each day. Unlike synthetic nitrogen, Pivot BioProven is not washed away, making crop yields more productive and more predictable. Pivot BioProven, nitrogen that stays put, weather or not. I always enjoy the chance to visit with our next guest. Ron Rabo farms in southeastern Wyoming. He has an operation that transitioned to organic production several years ago. His farming success is a story in its own right, but this time we are discussing the transition of the farm from one generation to the next. It's a topic that Ron speaks to many audiences about every year, a topic that was not easy for his family. As you'll hear, multiple family members were involved, and the outcome was far from clear. Ron walks through the steps we can take to help that transition go the best it can. Ron, you have been on our podcast before, but for those that don't remember, give a little background about your farm, where you're at, and so forth.
Yeah, I think we opened the last podcast with a alligator hunt, actually. And so, I live in southeastern Wyoming and grew up on I'm fifth generation on a working cattle ranch there. And honestly, it was a cattle ranch that was big enough to support one family, but we had four families that were living off of it. My dad passed away when he was 58. I was 25. And when he collapsed, I gave him CPR and he didn't make it. And so in my life, what that did is that just created a whole whirlwind of events in my life that I could have never imagined would have ever taken place. And so after 4 years of buying into the operation and dealing with distant family members who, the challenge, you know, in production agriculture, a lot of times when we have multiple families that are involved, the lineage may not be direct. I tell a lot of people that in our operation, it's like it's the same family tree, but it's completely different sides of different branches. And so so our operation was set up that way. And so in that particular setup, everyone owns everything. So I just look at it as no one really owns anything. Because you can't really definitively put your hands on what you own. And so in our case, we just had a lot of hands that were in the basket that wanted to take, but there wasn't that much to take. There wasn't that much to even earn on the place. And so the reason that our place had worked as long as it did is because everyone was willing to work for nothing. My dad made a few hundred dollars a month from the time up until he passed away, and that was it. And so everyone agreed in that generation that that's how they were going to make their particular operation work. And so, you know, this was in 1999. So, you know, 20, 21 years ago, as you and I both know, that production ag has changed tremendously. The changes on the farm alone, let alone in the industry as a whole, are massive. And so after being there for about 4 years, my wife and I just said, you know, there's a lot here that just can't be fixed. And the only way to fix it, to make it work for our own individual selves and for our own family, was to leave and to do something else. And so what we did is we ended up leaving the operation and then going out and building our own operation. And as a result of that, of course, we got some of the operation that we owned. But because my dad passed away out of order and our documents, you know, the will and whatnot was written so that my grandfather passed away first, not my dad. And so as a result, I ended up having to leave a lot at the ranch that I owned had I stayed, but when I left, I had to leave it there. And so we set out to build our own operation, and that's essentially what we started on about 16 years ago, and we've come a long way since then.
So this is kind of a topic that you're talking with people about now. So having lived through that situation, what do you now tell people as a starting point that they need to be thinking about now based on your experiences?
Sure. Well, first off, I have a book that's going to come out this year. It's called Make Your Own Way, and it's really about my story, but it's about the issue, the white elephant in the room that we all know that we need to talk about in production agriculture, and that is about how do we transition the farm to the next generation, or better yet, should we transition the farm at all? You know, I found myself really struggling with the fact that because I was fifth generation, an operation that had been in business for over 100 years, that I had to come to the realization that just because my great-great-grandmother had a dream to be a cattle rancher in southeastern Wyoming, it didn't mean that I had to have the same dream. You know, I'm a firm believer that we're all Americans. We live in America. It's the freest country the world's ever known. And we're responsible for our own choices. But we need to first identify with those of us who are involved in production agriculture that we have to own those choices, and that it's okay to be different. It's okay to not have the dream that your great-great-grandmother did, or your great-grandfather, your grandfather, or even your parents. We're all our own individuals, and the world changes all the time. And we need to recognize the fact that when we have different ambitions, that it's okay to have those different ambitions. And so my first piece of advice, as I go through the book and as I talk about my story and talk about how we can all learn from my experience, because essentially we're all in the same boat, right? That I have a list of different pieces of advice that I think where people should start. And the first one really is we need to start to have the conversation now. The problem is that when the matriarch or the patriarch or the family dies, and we have siblings or we have cousins or aunts and uncles, whatever it is, when those people are living, everyone says it's going to be just fine. But as soon as they pass away, the mentality completely shifts and everything changes. And so now you have siblings, for an example, who always got along well, who never had any arguments about the farm, and they might not have even ever had an interest in the farm. But as soon as mom or dad or grandma or grandpa have passed on, now all of that's changed. And so if we don't have those conversations while those people are living, then we're making a mistake. So even though they're hard conversations to have, because no one wants to talk about their own demise, no one wants to talk about the demise of a business, like in my case, was in our family for over 100 years, no one wanted to confront that. I mean, I remember going and having a conversation with my dad's cousins, knowing full well what I was going to propose. And even though I'd been working on it for 2 years, trying to work it out so that everyone could get along, I remember what that felt like to go have that meeting because I was 29 years old, and they were in their 60s. And I was going to be the punk kid that came in and said, hey, we need to change everything, and I'm going to stir the pot. So I get it. I understand it. I understand it's a hard conversation to have. But just because it's hard doesn't mean that we shouldn't have it. And just because we don't have it doesn't mean that those issues don't exist. So we have to begin by having that conversation while we're alive, when we get along, and when we still like each other.
So if I can get to the point where I'm going to have that conversation, is there any way that that conversation should go? Is it talking about what my hopes, dreams, goals are for that farm? How do I begin then to figure this out? Because hopefully everybody can at least talk at this point and get along halfway, but how should the conversation go?
Well, I think it's a two-sided conversation. So it can't just only be about you as an individual. And the way that I approached this when I approached our own family situation was I had listened to my dad's cousins for years and years say, we'd like to retire, but we don't have enough money to retire. I wish I owned a piece of the ranch that I could sell so I could retire. So I listened to that for years. And so I played into that as part of my conversation with them, that this isn't just about what Ron Rabo wants. This is about what everyone who's involved, which at the time we were all equal partners. So I can't just make it about myself. It's got to be about every single person involved. And the fact of the matter is we have to be real with ourselves, that you can tell when someone is on the ranch and they just want to milk the ranch for all that they possibly can. You can tell the people that are motivated. You can tell the people that, you know, in my case, there were, you know, guys in their middle 60s, they didn't want to grow. They had no interest in growing. They had no reason to grow. But they knew that if they stayed there and someone else came on board, that they could at least continue to maintain the small level of living that they had without having to change much. So change is hard, and it's difficult for all of us to accept. But at that particular pivotal point in time, it's an important thing to address, that it's not, this is not just about what I want. It's got to be about what all the partners want. Let's have a real discussion about where this place is at right now and where all of us see it going in the future as individuals.
So if I've had that conversation, I'm interested in what happened with you, because you certainly wanted to farm, you wanted to grow the operation, but you had to leave some of it behind. So how did you then, was it just take on the debt? How does a person that wants to get in there but still needs to buy several people out, how do they make it happen?
That's a great question. And actually, I didn't know I wanted to farm. I actually had no idea what I was going to do, but things got so ugly in the relationships at the ranch that I came home and I told my wife, I said, I don't know what we're going to do, but we're not going to do this. So first, sometimes, you know, you've heard the old adage that if you don't know what you want to do, then at least figure out what you don't want to do. And so I started in the reverse way, which was I know for sure that I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to raise my family. I'm not going to stay married. I'm not going to be in business where every single day I show up and I want to throw up because everyone wants to argue all the time. And when I see that there's opportunity on the horizon, no one wants to grasp that opportunity, why in the world would I want to stay in that cycle? Why would I want to do that to myself? Why would I want to do that to my children? And I looked at it from my standpoint that for goodness sakes, even if I didn't know what I wanted to do, it wasn't fair that if I were to pass away next, that I put my wife and my children in the position that I got put into. And so I had no idea what I was going to do. So when we left, we actually about lost everything that we had because we were going backwards. We thought, well, anything is better, except when you're losing it all, right? And so I always said to myself that I can accept responsibility if I fail, because I can do that on my own accord. Except when I started to fail, I thought, well, maybe that wasn't such a good idea after all. But what you do is you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, because we are the freest country in the world and because we can make our own choices, and you figure it out. And so what we did in our particular sense is we went in and we sold over 85% of everything that we owned, and we started over. And we had to start over with land. We had to start over with facilities. We had to start over with all of our infrastructure, with all of our equipment, everything. We started from scratch. And so what we did is we just said, we will figure it out. And so for our business, we found a niche industry in the organic business. And so what we've done is we've raised a lot of crops, and we've found the markets, and we've catered to those markets, and we built the relationships that are necessary to become successful in that business. And that's how we've grown our farm, and that's how we've made it work.
We've always got so many topics to cover. We'll have to do the organic at some point. But before we get done with this, I know the book isn't out yet, but tell people the name of the book and kind of how and when they're going to find it.
Absolutely. So the name of the book is called Make Your Own Way. And you will be able to find it on Amazon, but most particularly you'll be able to find it on our website. That's our farm website, and that's rabofarms.com. So it's R-A-B as in boy, O-U, farms.com.
Take time to follow Ron on Facebook. As he mentioned, he'll have a book coming out later this year, and we'll try to connect with him again to get some more ideas on that topic. And thanks to you for listening to our show. We'll be back next week with another edition of Farming the Countryside. The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for. The nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com.